You're listening to The Breakfast Show here on Faith FM with myself, Scaffy, my friend Jules, and my friend producer Shell. We are here today to bless your morning with some fun, entertaining things, plus God's Word. We are going to be talking about bird watching in this segment. We're going to be talking about tobacco and gambling. We are going to be talking about, you know, how the stories that we tell about ourselves to ourselves actually have a massive impact in our own mental health. That's going to be a fascinating conversation with our psychologist, Maria Andreoli, at 7:35. A bunch of really interesting things going on. We also have a number of people that I'd like to give a shout out. Shout out to Rebecca, Janelle. Rebecca actually sent us the hashtag Prince. So we will be sending her a free copy of the book, The Prince of Peace, which is our giveaway today. You can learn more about that later. Shout out to Devo, to Valme, and to Maui. Maui said that he gave us his good morning. Good morning back to you, Maui. He's texting us from Mount Isa. That's really cool. That's really far away from here. So Mount Isa.
Queensland?
Yeah, Queensland. Mm. Amazing. Thank you very much,
Maui.
I
wonder what the weather's like up there today.
You wonder?
Yeah.
Oh, well, we can find out in...
Be warm.
Yeah, bomb.gov.au. Yeah. All right, producer Shell, let's start this segment.
We also
got
a lovely message from Wayne this morning.
Oh, yes, that's right. Like, let me read the message from Wayne. Thank you, Wayne, for your message. He said, hey, good morning, blessings. I love you all. Looking to the cross, what an inspiration you are, Lord. You laid it all down at the cross, all the pain, your willpower and your love for the Father and all humans. You gave everything. At the end of the pain, it will all pay off. Jesus is my inspiration when I run marathons and I put all I have in spreading the word and his love to reach others. Amen, Lord. Thank you very much, Wayne. That's a beautiful message indeed. Thanks for your little devotion. Now, Jules, let's talk about bird watching.
Bird watching.
Yes. Why
let's
is that becoming
quiz
a thing?
First.
Oh, we haven't done the quiz yet. All right. Sorry, producer.
You nearly
Shell.
Got there, but then I cut you off. So it's
oh,
my fault.
That's right.
Scaffy's so excited to hear about bird watching.
Oh, I do too. I love that. Okay. How many of Jesus' 12 disciples are specifically recorded as being present at the cross? How many of Jesus' 12 disciples are specifically recorded as being present at the cross? We have one correct answer so far. No, just Scaffy's got that one right this morning. 0491-064-669, 0491-064-669. Nine. Text in, how many of Jesus' 12 disciples are named as being present at the cross?
Okay.
Are you texting in, Scaffy?
I'm not texting in. I'm just opening up my bird app here so I can give some statistics about my birding pursuits as well after you share about, you know, birding and Gen Zs.
I did not know you were a secret bird watcher.
Not so secret, but yes, I'm a bird watcher. Yes,
wow.
I love to watch birds.
Well, the reason I picked this story was that yesterday when I arrived home, on my front lawn were two galahs. And for some reason, I just thought these galahs look pretty relaxed. And I pulled up next to them and this guy kind of came hopping over to me, this little pink galah. And I said, hello, Cocky. And he said, hello, Cocky.
Oh, and he was a pet one.
He must have been a pet one.
Oh,
and I said, how you doing? He
really?
Goes, hello, Cocky. How you doing?
No way.
No way. And he kept saying it. How you doing? And I thought, you are definitely someone's pet. But he had a mate like 2 meters away as well. So I thought, I don't know.
He's obviously gotten himself free somehow and made himself a partner.
Started a little family.
So. Yeah, because they mate for life, don't they, galahs?
Yeah, birds in general.
Birds in general. It's so
but I didn't
beautiful.
Know that. Actually, to me, it's a novelty that galahs can actually speak.
I thought it was just cockatoos, but this guy was, I'll show you the
pretty
video.
Pretty much all parrots
later.
Can.
Yeah, right. Amazing. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm, you know, but no, not all parrots, surely not. Lorikeets couldn't. Could they?
I don't know.
There's a lot of different parrots that can talk.
I think lorikeets can.
Yeah. I've seen Indian miners talking.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I know that if you cut the tongue of a crow, it can talk.
Oh, really?
Cut the tongue.
Yeah, but it's not allowed anymore, obviously.
It's
cruel.
Not. Very cruel. But isn't that funny that without the tongue
it's just
it
a slice.
Talk?
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Anyway, so this guy was so tame, he jumped up on top of our car and I videoed him for a little bit going, he's saying, hello, Cocky. And then I said to my daughter, go and get him some food. And after that, he flew off. He pooped on our car and he flew off. But he had a flock of birds with him. So I think he's found his happiness. And I was so happy that he was free, this bird.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing. Anyway, so I came across this article about how bird watching has become an unexpected hit with Gen Z. And they call this crew birders. I guess it's a bit like anoraks, who are those people, mad people that follow trains and watch trains mm-hmm. and take photos of trains. So, but a new wave of young birders is helping to turn one of Britain's oldest outdoor pastimes into one of the fastest growing hobbies. So Ben Smith is a bird watcher in Scotland who begins the day just before sunrise with a flask of tea and his binoculars, and he walks to one of his favourite local trails. He's saying he doesn't necessarily have to see anything special, but he writes everything down that he sees, and maybe if,
oh, really?
Yes, if he's lucky, he gets a snap on his camera. But he's 23 and he's one of almost 750,000 Gen Z Brits who regularly enjoy bird watching. And this is according to research by a company called 55 Blue and the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. That marks, let me tell you, a 1,088% increase since 2018 of young people who are bird watching now, making bird watching it's the second fastest growing hobby among 16 to 29 year olds in Britain. And can you?
That is amazing.
Yes.
Wow. We just need to have these Brits, you know, sharing their enthusiasm with the Aussies here. Because in Australia, like, we're so blessed to have so many birds.
So
like,
many.
They don't have as many birds. I don't think they have like half of the amounts of species in Europe, across Europe, than we have here in Australia. Pretty much, we have more birds here than they have in Europe, hands down.
Absolutely. And there's those funny videos where they show birds in Britain as like, dee, 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 tweet, 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 tweet. And then they show the birds of Australia like, ah, ah. Our birds are pretty noisy. But anyway, can you guess what the biggest hobby amongst Gen Z is in Britain?
Pickleball.
Pickleball. No, it's jewellery making.
Jewellery
making? Yeah, I know, right?
I would not see that one coming.
Me neither. I was blown away by that one. Anyway, so it's no longer like a hobby just of old retired people. Young people are getting into it, and it's kind of coming back as a bit of a cool thing to do. And Smith spends his time around Loch Lomond in Scotland and traces his love of birds back to childhood trips with his dad, who was a van driver that worked night shifts across rural Scotland. He said he'd wake up in the van and they'd look for raptors while they drove, red kites, kestrels, peregrine falcons and eagles.
Nice.
And that kind of inspired his love of birds. And he later volunteered in high school community garden and he joined the Royal Society of Protection for Birds. They had a youth council and he went on to study zoology. And
wow.
Ecology at the University of Glasgow. So he's made a career out of it, this love of birds. And he's currently studying for a master's, which is such great news because obviously there's a crew of people out there who want to protect birds and they're so essential for our ecology.
They are, absolutely.
Across the UK, more than 4 million people now birdwatch, and that's up 47% in the last 6 years. Yeah, 4 million people are birdwatchers.
That is a lot.
I know. You wouldn't think so, would you?
No.
Yeah. So while Gen Z has seen the sharpest rise, interest is also growing among like millennials. It's up 216% in millennials and Gen X, which is up 66%. So there's this huge rise in birdwatching and he believes it's because of the climate doom and gloom that's come. I think the young people realize
paying more attention to God's creation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, look, there's so many benefits to bird watching. And let me tell you this, bird watching is so good for your health because it gets you out there, gets you walking, gets you soaking the goodness of trees. And there's some research that has found that listening to the chirping of birds has real benefits to mental health. It reduces anxiety, reduces depression. It even increases the immune system just by listening to birds. It's actually quite therapeutic.
It's not surprising.
Not surprising at all. And look, there's one thing about hobbies. Like, hobbies can be expensive pursuits. Bird watching, it's one of the very few hobbies that you can do for absolutely free.
I don't know. I've heard of people who have traveled the entire world who cross off their list.
Look, you can spend. Not saying that it's always free, but if you don't have a single penny in your pocket, you can still go out in the bush somewhere and just look at at birds.
That's true. Shortland, you know, the wetlands?
Yes. And we have here like some incredible spots near Newcastle, as you mentioned, the wetlands in Shortland. Look, of course, you can spend as much as you want. You know, Producer Shaw, if you do like to spend your money with hobbies, I can give you some very interesting bird watching resources. You can buy some binoculars for $10,000.
$10,000.
You can buy camera lenses for like $20,000-$30,000. Plus camera combo, so like the sky is the limit. However, if you don't want to spend a single cent, you can still enjoy bird watching. And look, I enjoyed hiking a lot and walking bush walks in nature. And when you start becoming interested in birds and then like also insects and, you know, mushrooms and plants, basically every hike becomes like a classroom.
Absolutely.
And I'm leaving open outdoor museum where there's so many interesting things to see instead of just like, yeah, just let me just walk from point A to point B.
That's right. And at school for your children, you can teach your children about life and nature. Yeah. And yeah, when I walk my dogs in the bush, I know the magpies crow in a certain way when my dogs come, and it's a different I can tell they're telling each other dogs are coming, because it's a totally different call than their other calls.
Yeah.
So I recognize it straight away because I've been walking in the bush for so many
years. They do, actually. Yeah. And you know what? The kangaroos can recognize they are known to know the different calls from magpies and currawongs and other birds.
Yes.
And so, for example, when they have this call for dingoes, which I imagine would be the same one for dogs, kangaroos just they take off.
Wow.
So magpies are also the alarm of nature.
Oh, that's fascinating. I love that.
Yeah, and kangaroos know how to interpret that.
That yeah, amazing.
Who taught them that?
God.
Yeah.
Yeah. And nature is just a wonderful thing. And, you know, there was another story about a little sparrow. But he was saying as well the social aspect of bird watching. Yeah. It's that there's many clubs. There's many clubs that you can join even around Australia if you really want to get into bird watching. But, you know, I just think it's an amazing way to see and experience God's beautiful creations. And, you know, and it says God's concerned even about the smallest sparrow. And if he's so concerned about the sparrow, of course he's concerned about us. So
yeah,
get out there, enjoy some bird watching. And you can do it in your backyard.
And if you want me to share my life list with you, I have identified 208 species.
Oh, Scaffy, well done.
There you go. So
there's once a year when they do a like a push through Australia to get everybody to count the birds in their yard. Have you done that one?
I have.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, so I take part in that. It's good fun.
It is.
Because we have a lot of black cockies around our place, so it's fun just trying to count how many of those we have at one time, you know, in the trees and that sort of thing.
That's amazing. They're my favorite birds, black cockatoos. I just think they're
They're so
the
full of grace.
The gang is my favorite Australian bird, but the hummingbird is.
You're listening to the Breakfast Show podcast on Faith FM. Positively different.
And we are now going to be revealing the answer to the quiz question. How many of the disciples of Jesus were mentioned by name?
There was just the one mentioned by name, John.
John.
When Jesus asked him to look after his mama.
That's right. Where did all the other disciples...
Where did they go?
Well, they fled. They were afraid. They didn't want the same thing to happen to them.
There might have been a couple more there. That's the only one that is named, though,
yeah,
that we specifically have mentioned. Yeah.
Well, look, Psalm 88, which is a messianic psalm, says that all of my friends have abandoned me. So I would imagine that this applying to Jesus means that, you know, like Peter, a lot of the disciples just like disappeared when things got hard.
It would be hard to watch. I mean, it would be
Hard to watch. It would be fearful as well. And yeah. So, but John was there.
Yeah.
Good on him. All right, Producer Shell, thank you very much for that quiz question. Let's talk about tobacco. Let's talk about gambling and some of the recent news here. So from the tobacco side of things, one of the big news is that Pauline Hanson came up with one proposal of her plans. And I think that as she is being contemplated more and more as in a viable alternative for prime minister in Australia, we are also seeing more and more concrete law proposals and projects from One Nation. And one of them is that they pledge to reduce the tobacco excise by 75%.
That's a lot, which is going to make cigarettes cheaper, isn't it?
Much cheaper. So let's say if a cigarette that's, you know, it's a pack of cigarettes costing like $100 will now cost, you know, after if the law passes, you know, they're going to be supporting that, it's going to come down to about $25. which is round about the price that it is reportedly being asked for tobacco in the black market. So the whole problem here for this situation, how it came there, is that, look, while Australia has been lauded around the world for really tackling head-on the tobacco issue, over the recent years, it kind of had backfired in some way. So it did cut a lot of usage of tobacco, first with the ads not having any attractiveness in the cigarette boxes, then with this massively big excise, a lot of people, they just gave up on smoking, just became too expensive. And that also raised a lot of funds for the federal government that could be used to fund things like healthcare and so on. However, what has been happening is that there has been a massive influx of illegal tobacco in the country, and it's just been very hard to tackle. I mean, Australia has a very big shoreline, and it's hard to enter every time that illegal boats are entering to Australia with loads. I think that the police is under-resourced to tackle that effectively. And on top of that, initially, when the excises were generating the most revenue for the federal government, they were generating about $18 billion a year. And now that's at an all-time low at about like maybe $10-12 billion a year. So the government is also feeling, the loss of revenue. And and that trend is not going up. It's only going down. And on top of that, there is the whole organized crime. The crime, syndicates that are selling this tobacco, they have been increasing, fire bombings and like tobacco shops just being set on fire, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, shootouts. And so the solution that One Nation with Pauline Hanson found was, hey, you know what? Let's just stifle and suffocate the organized crime by selling tobacco at the same prices that they do, so that people would go through the legal ones instead of the illegal ones.
Yeah. What do you think about that, Skeffy?
Look, from a policy perspective, I wish that we could just be tougher and harder on not allowing illegal tobacco to come in. I think that the less tobacco, the better the country will be, the healthier we will be.
Absolutely.
And I think that people will find other ways to spend their money with. I think that it destroys your health. It takes your money away. It's just not great stewardship. Yeah.
My father had lung cancer and passed away. So my father was a smoker all his life, and he died at age of 65.
Wow.
Yeah, too young.
Yeah, I lost my father at the age of 57 for a lung issue as well caused by tobacco. So he died also very prematurely, so like to your father. So it's quite personal to me.
It does. Yeah, same. Yeah.
So that's that on the tobacco side of things. And then on the gambling side of things, so it looks like the Labour and Coalition are partnering together to propose a law that is going to toughen up some regulations around sports gambling. So gambling has been a big thing in Australia. There's one statistics that I believe like last year, Australians, they on average lose $25.5 billion. For gambling
which
is a lot of money. Imagine what can be done with that.
Yes.
And gambling is very addictive as well. I was listening to a story of a man in the United States, Bruce Rochelle, who was addicted to baseball cards. And they have this app. I don't know if there are in Australia, if there exists. Probably you could download. I don't remember the name, but it's an app. Like, it's kind of like a TikTok, but for online auctions.
Yeah, okay.
And it's highly addictive. And this man was buying like these, mystery boxes with, hundreds of baseball cards in the hopes of getting a really valuable one. Yeah. And he did so for a number of, I think, 4 months. Guess how much money did he ended up spending?
How much?
$1.4 million US.
You're kidding.
And of course, he lost his house. He lost his family because of that. He lost his job. He actually had even at some point, they took money from his corporate credit card from his company that he worked for to pay for that addiction.
Yeah. So he's not paying them
back.
Too.
Lost his job too. It has been so devastating, and he's now in a rehabilitation. But it's just to show the effects that gambling can cause on people.
Devastating.
And so the government is coming up with a law. And look, I think it's a step in the right direction. I definitely don't think it's enough. Basically, what they're doing is, have you heard about the do not call register? in Australia? Did you know that? You know how when people call you, like, no, they want to, you know, with spams, like advertising, oh, change your electricity provider.
Yes, those lovely people.
That's right. There is a do not call register in Australia. That you can. It's a government thing. You can register your number. And then legitimate companies that are not scammers, they have to, before they call you, they look if your number is in that register. And if it is, they don't call you.
Yeah, okay, good.
And they're going to create something similar to gambling. So if you register your email address in that register, then websites that would be promoting or enticing people with gambling ads, they'll have to just give different ads.
Yeah.
You won't be able to have gambling ads. So same thing across social media. They won't be able to bother you there.
It's a great initiative.
It's a great initiative
that is going to thwart the hand.
It is helpful.
Yeah.
That also extends to television. So they're aiming to limit at maximum of three gambling ads per hour.
Yep.
From during the prime time, from 5:30 a.m. to like 8 p.m. And also for people that are just joining into these apps, they are not allowed to receive any free offers, like free gambling, you know, free bets, until like a certain period of time, like 7 days or 14 days, depending on the period. It's still going to be discussed. Or if you have excluded yourself from these gambling ads websites, then 90 days of wait time before these companies can offer you free bets.
Do you think these are effective implements to...
Look, honestly, I don't think it's going to be very effective at all. I think the most effective implement is knowing God. Yeah. And there is a reason why Christians traditionally don't partake in gambling. And I would say many Christians as well don't partake in the use of body-harming drugs, because there's the Bible tells that greed is an idol,
yeah,
and gambling is about greed. The Bible also tells us that, no, don't do unto others what you don't want to be done unto you. And gambling is basically you're winning something at the expense of someone else.
Of course,
so you wouldn't want someone to just be taking your money to give to someone else. So why would we do that to someone else? So if you think about it, it's not in harmony with our Christian faith and calling to love and serve others.
No, we're just serving another god, really. Gambling is a god. And
gambling and the stomach is a god as well. So also destroying our health and our capacity to serve God for longer because of a momentary, temporary pleasure, it's another form of idolatry. And for those, and once you already get addicted to it, it's so hard. This is why the Bible has two passages that are some of my favorites. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 23, and 1 Corinthians 6, verse 12, they're similar passages, parallel passages, I would even say, where Paul says, yes, sure, everything is permissible, but not everything is profitable. And this, the chapter 6, it says, I will not let anything master or have dominion or control over me.
Mm.
So for the Christian, God says, look, I don't want you to be a slave to anything, to any kind of addiction.
No.
I haven't created you for that. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 23, it says, I'm not going to partake in anything that does not edify. Mm. So Christians are there to edify either themselves or others. And because of that worldview, I believe it is incompatible with the high calling that God has for us to be engaged in things that harm us, that don't edify us, that destroy neighbors, communities, families, that keep us addicted, that incentivize greed. It's just you know, not aligned with the lifestyle of service, of humility, of contentment that Jesus is offering to us as the real alternative of how to be really happy as a human being.
You're listening to the Breakfast Show podcast on Faith FM, positively different.
And we now would like to welcome our psychologist, Maria Andreoli. She's going to be sharing with us about the stories that we tell ourselves in our heads, the narratives that we use to, you know, how they impact our own mental health. And that's an absolutely fascinating topic. Maria, good morning to you. It's great to have you here with us this morning.
Good morning, Scaffy. It's great to be back on.
And Maria, look, can you give us a little bit of a recap? Because you started that conversation already. So what are we looking at exactly?
So last fortnight, we introduced this idea of how we all carry a narrative identity, We all carry a story about our own life. And sometimes it's, you know, various different stories about our life. And we talked about how people who have better kind of articulated and better laid out narrative identities seem to have better mental health. So we talked about the importance of being able to, like, if someone asked you to share your story, how would you share that story? Mm. And we talked about how people who are able to kind of break their story down into different sequences, people who have like different, almost like chapters about their life story, just tend to have better well-being overall.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating, because this is something that we don't really talk about very often, like how we tell ourselves about our own stories and how we tell others about our own stories. So what are some of the pitfalls here? What are some of the negative patterns that we should avoid?
So, yeah, there's a few different ways that we can tell our story, right? And I think I need to quickly outline something I said shared last time, was that our brain doesn't remember events like a camera would capture something on film. There is no like wave, like our brain doesn't record memories perfectly. Our memories can shift and change over time. Mm-hmm. They can change based on how we're feeling in any given particular day. Mm-hmm. They can be, you know, edited and shifted, and we can focus on different parts of our life and like highlight different key moments and create different stories based off what we highlight. So that's the way our memory works, right? So if we're talking about what are some pitfalls, you know, what are some ways that we can kind of like cut and edit our stories in ways that will be negative for us? There's a few different things, but since we're starting with the negative one, there's something called a contamination story. So researchers looking at this way that people tell their stories to themselves and to other people, there's a theme that comes out that's called contamination. Mm. So a contamination story, like, you can break it down into three different parts. It's this idea of something good once existed, but then this painful event happened. And after that, nothing was ever the same. Mm. So anyone who carries this kind of story with them tends to have just greater rates of depression overall. And it doesn't necessarily change, like, it's not necessarily impacted by what actually happened. It's really just the way that we view that event. Like, was that the thing that changed my life for the worse, and nothing was quite the same after that? So that's a contamination story. It's probably the most harmful story.
That is absolutely fascinating, because I can see patterns. When I talk to people, and I can see now how that story has been shared with you so many times. I never really had a label to put on it, but it makes a lot of sense. It's a full, complete narrative arc, really, but it's a bit of a horror story that we tell ourselves, isn't it?
Yeah. It is a horror story, isn't it? But it has an impact. Like, they've actually done research specifically on people trying to come out of addiction. And they found that people who carried contamination stories were only, like, in a specific group, were only 44% likely to come out of their addiction. But people who didn't carry those contamination stories were 83% more likely to stay sober.
Wow.
So it impacts our habits, our behavior, our ability to recover as well.
So so that's contamination. What are other patterns of stories that we tell ourselves?
So maybe let's start with the one that I think is kind of like the opposite to a contamination story. And it's called a redemption story. Mm. So you can imagine where this one goes. It's about something painful has happened, and I went through this really hard time, but eventually something life-giving came out of it. Something positive turned around for me. And the positive thing might not be something that happened in my own life. It could be something that happened inside of me. It could be something inside of me changed for the better, right? But it's just this idea. It doesn't mean that the bad thing I went through was a good thing, but what came out of it was eventually good. So people who have those redemption stories and carry them with them, they just do better overall. They have better well-being, better mental health, and stronger sense of life purpose, I guess.
Do you think that this is where the Bible kind of aligns us or encourages us to really see our lives through those lenses of redemption as well? Or do you think that the Bible is more like on the contamination side of things? What is your perspective as a you know, from a Bible perspective?
The Bible is a narrative, and it's a narrative that ties us in, that involves us, that tells us that we're part of a greater story in which eventually the good side wins and everything is redeemed. So the Bible is one great redemption story.
It's true.
And we are a key character in that story.
That's amazing. And look, absolutely. And one of the passages that I was thinking of, you know, is when Jesus says, for example, blessed are you when you're persecuted, because, you know, this is what they've done with the prophet. So even he's getting something negative, but he's giving a, hey, when something negative happens to you, guess what? You actually can celebrate because something positive will come out of that on the other side.
Absolutely.
You know, and
absolutely, all the way, yeah. Great.
In everything, give thanks. Another one, like how can we give everything thanks? Well, because in every story, even in negative things, God is able to bring good out of evil.
Yeah, absolutely, and like be patient when you go through various trials, because we know the testing of our patience eventually produces character and hope. So if I honestly believe that if we are reading our Bibles often, our brains, and really taking it in, our brains will be wired towards looking for redemption stories in various parts of our life.
Amazing.
Because it teaches us that way of thinking.
Yes. Oh, that's really fascinating. Look, contamination stories, redemption stories, this is very fascinating. What else, you know, can we learn about that world of our internal narratives? Are there other patterns?
So there's two more. There's two more that have been quite researched. One of them that has a lot of evidence behind it is this idea of agency. So agency asks the question of like, what role did I play or how much choice did I have? So people who are able to look back on their stories and identify that they had some level of choice, that they had options, basically that life wasn't just happening to them, right? Things weren't just happening. They weren't just a victim, but there were maybe factors outside of their control, but they were able to take steps within that. People who have that greater sense of agency tend to have better mental health. So there's actually been a big research study that looked at people over 9 years. And they found that even when they controlled for that person's, those people's personality traits, and they even controlled for how the stories ended up, if they had greater agency, they just had lower depression. So agency, I'm recognizing might be a bit confusing, but some examples could be, I don't know, I didn't choose my diagnosis, but I chose to take steps to better my health. Okay. Or I didn't choose being betrayed by someone, but I chose not to let that bitterness overtake my future. So it's people who are able to find an element of choice. They don't walk through life feeling powerless or like life just happens, but they're able to see where they have that personal responsibility and choice.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, what you're sharing, Maria, because it's sometimes we can be victims, but at the same time, sometimes we can tell ourselves victim stories because there is some kind of comfort in feeling the victim and, you know, receiving the attention of other people. It can even be a little bit addictive, and then we can just start seeing that victim, oh, I'm a victim mentality everywhere, but that's not really conducive to good mental health. But if we take ownership and say, you know what, I there are things that I can choose. I can choose. It's very empowering to think that way.
Absolutely. And look, the reality is that sometimes absolutely awful things happen to people. And but even like newer kind of approaches, for example, dealing with women who've come out of domestic violence, you know, the therapists realized they needed to change the language with how we told, like what we told those women that they were, like they couldn't just keep calling them victims, you know, because that wasn't helpful for the women. And they actually changed the language to calling them survivors.
Oh, that's
right?
Why.
Because the way we think about things matters, you know,
yeah.
And we don't want to keep someone trapped in that state of, pain, but being able to see them as, you know, we didn't control the way we were treated, but we had agency in the steps we took once we came out of that situation. And being able to view our stories in that way just protects us from developing depression.
That's fascinating. I never really thought about that because, yes, I've seen so many, you know, like there's that shift in language, particularly, as you mentioned, for people that experience the, you know, the horrors of domestic violence. Into I'm the domestic violence survivor, cancer survivor. And I never realized how powerful just that small shift would have in someone's identity.
Yeah, well, our stories are really just a collection of words. So language is really powerful. I really think that, you know, what we think doesn't shape our language, but the language we use also shapes the way we view the world. And that's a big part of how we tell our stories is the language that we choose.
And what's the fourth pattern that you wanted to share with us around that that fascinating field of narratives and the stories that we tell ourselves?
Well, the fourth one's not as well researched, but it's still really important, too important not to add. But it's this theme of communion. It's this idea of being able to, in your story, as you're telling yourself your story and telling other people your story, being able to recognize the people that showed up for you, the people who, not just the ones who betrayed you, but the ones who stayed with you, the ones who loved you through it all, the ones who encouraged you. Right. So this theme of communion, and again, people who are able to focus on those parts of their story as they tell themselves and other people their story, focus on the places where they did feel connected, they did feel loved, and people were there for them and helping them, were also able to have just greater well-being overall. And I think that this part's not as researched, but I think it's important to really include is even if maybe people weren't there, I think if we're talking about the Bible, and as we were mentioning earlier, like we can always focus on the ways that God showed up even in those hard times. And I think that that would also tie in to that communion theme.
Look, I'm blown away, Maria, because I never learned about those things. And to me, it's all brand new, but I find it fascinating that psychologists were able to find those patterns. And I can definitely relate it to the Bible. For example, in regard to that point of communion, it's so fascinating. But when we think of the story of Joseph in the Bible, every time that something horrible was happening with Joseph, the Bible says, and God was with Joseph. It's almost like emphasizing, hey, by the way, Joseph was not alone. God was helping him in the midst of all of that. And I find it fascinating because, you know, when I look into my life and my stories of, you know, being betrayed or being unfairly dealt with, we often emphasize the perpetrator of that pain, but never emphasize enough the people that actually stood by our side. And that's a shift that I want to make in my own life stories from now on.
And I think that's a shift that it would benefit everyone to make, wouldn't it? So I would actually encourage, you know, the people listening to this, if they've really, you know, found the message helpful, it'd be really good to just pull out the pen and paper, you know, at some point and go through your story, but be aware of these themes. You know, be aware of the agency that was there, the communion that you had, maybe even in Christ, and the redemption that came through. And maybe there's been a particularly painful event that you haven't, you know, been able to work through, but try to rethink it and rewrite it. I think that would be a pretty helpful thing to do.
Absolutely. No, this is amazing. I'm going to be sharing that with all my friends from now on, Maria, because I think this is absolutely fascinating, groundbreaking stuff. And sometimes like getting to know these patterns really help to unlock our brains, our thought patterns to something much healthier than what we are accustomed to. Thank you so much for sharing this incredible knowledge with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. And look, if, as Maria said, look, one of the things that I believe will help us generate, and particularly in our children, you know, they're in these formative years of their character. They're learning how to think. They're learning how to process. They're learning how to retell how to tell their own stories. But as we just heard from Maria, seeing our own stories in the big narrative, in the big big backdrop story of the Bible, helps us to see what is our place in the great scheme of things.
Thanks for being a part of the Faith FM family. Join our community on Facebook or get in touch at 1-800-FAITH-FM.